Sabatone.
Thank you, Ken. We know each other well. No introductions. I told him my mother isn't here. It's not necessary. I dispense with the introduction, and I'm going to be relatively brief with the comments because I'm obviously going to talk about the presidential election, and I know you all are interested in it and have questions, and we'll be a lot better off with Q&A than we will be with lectures. So that's what we're going to do, and I'll look forward to getting your comments and questions very shortly. And over the next hour, I hope we can cover a lot of ground. If you doubt that Pat Buchanan is really shaking things up in more ways than one, and if you doubt that his nomination, if it actually happened, would be a disaster for the Republican Party, then you need to just review one of David Letterman's top 10 lists. And I'm not going to read them all because some of them are too obscene for this group. But top 10 ways Buchanan celebrated his victory. I suppose this was in New Hampshire, or maybe the victory the media projected in Arizona that didn't happen with those phony exit polls that they do, that they'll eventually learn not to conduct in the way that they do. But that's probably in the year 2000. Number 10, beer and pizza with the Grand Wizard. 9, chased a group of Canadian tourists back across the border. Threw confetti made from the Bill of Rights. Drank a bottle of victory champagne with Mark Furman. And my personal favorite, invaded a Polish restaurant. Things are really hopping, and that's for sure. Buchanan has done some things that nobody really expected him to do, although in these very low turnout primaries, I don't think anything is terribly surprising. You just have a handful of activists showing up, and when that occurs, anybody can win these things, especially given the kinds of ideologues who show up, both right-wing and left-wing in the Democratic Party in primaries and caucuses. The vast majority of people don't participate. And the people who do tend to be toward the ends of the ideological spectrum. And we've seen it over and over and over again. And until centrists get involved, until people who are in the middle of the spectrum, whether to the right of center, to the left of center, or at dead center, start participating in these nominating contests, we're going to see more Pat Buchanan's doing well. So it's a real challenge to, first of all of us, to participate. And secondly, it's a challenge to the parties to try to draw in more of those swing voters that really make a difference in the general election. And they're not doing a very good job of attracting them. There is an element in both parties that doesn't want the center to participate because, of course, the more centrists participate, the less likely they are to have their preferences ideologically and to have their agendas enacted by the party once it's over. So right now, we've obviously got a muddle. I mean, it's an amazing situation. It's a total muddle in the Republican Party. It's only four-cornered, truly four-cornered presidential nominating process in modern times. Frequently, you'll have two. Occasionally, you'll have three major candidates, but it's extremely rare in the age of the front-loaded primary system to have a real four-way race, which is what you have right now. And you have no real front runner. The closest thing is still Bob Dole, who's lost the real mantle. Buchanan would be a close second, Forbes would be a close third, and Alexander would be a close fourth, more or less a close fourth. And remember, before you write him off, everybody wrote Steve Forbes off, and then came Delaware and Arizona. So he might surprise us in an additional primary or two and suddenly be back in contention. He's not, in all likelihood, going to win South Carolina, but he's making a stand in South Carolina and Georgia. He's making a stand on Super Tuesday in a number of southern states. He's making a stand in a number of the northeastern states for the Yankee primary on Tuesday. So who can say? Obviously, the critical primary at this point is in South Carolina on Saturday. For Dole, that's a must-win. If he doesn't win that, I really do think, or at least I can say some Republican leaders, including some in the Dole camp, believe it will be the beginning of the end for his candidacy. He ought to win it. He has the strong support of Governor Beasley, former Governor Campbell, Strom Thurmond, which guarantees the 93-year-old vote. And by the way, March the 6th, critical day on March the 6th, Strom Thurmond becomes the oldest person ever to serve in the United States Senate, succeeding, some of you will remember him, Democratic Senator Ted Green of Rhode Island, who left office in, I think, 1960, having retired by force. He didn't want to retire. He was literally muscled out of the Democratic primary that year. He retired at the age of 93 years and 3 months, and he is to this point the oldest ever to have served in the Senate, and Strom Thurmond will be succeeding him. But anyway, Dole has the support of virtually the entire superstructure of the Republican Party in South Carolina. Forbes is not doing what he does best, which is spending lavishly in South Carolina, the way he did in Arizona, the way he did in Iowa, the way he did in New Hampshire, the way he did in Delaware. So Dole doesn't have to worry about that. Dole has the support of most of the leadership of the Christian Coalition in South Carolina. They've tried to pick a winner in South Carolina. They've tried to think forward to the general election. One of the most amazing statistics that I've come across the entire election season was in New Hampshire, where a majority of those who voted for Pat Buchanan said he couldn't beat Clinton in November. Now think about that. A majority of the people who voted for him said he couldn't beat Clinton in November. I'm confused, Ken. I thought that was the purpose of a nominating contest, was to select someone who would win in November. But how naive. In any event, I guess they stuck with principles, and I don't want to get into any argument with any Buchananite in the audience. But still, it's a very unusual result. Whether you like or dislike Buchanan, normally people who vote for a candidate believe, however naively, that they can actually win in November. To the contrary, I think it's obvious that Buchanan would be a disaster. The Republican Party has tried to live down for years the label it acquired during the New Deal period, which was the stupid party. You remember? And they called themselves that because they have missed so many opportunities. They've nominated a number of very bad candidates and missed a lot of opportunities along the way. My point would be, if they nominate Buchanan, the good news is they will no longer be the stupid party. The bad news is they will be the insane party. For Pat Buchanan, happiness is a divided opposition. And obviously that's what he depends on, and that's why the muddle has been so helpful to him, because he's got three other relatively strong candidates. He's one of these candidates who has a high floor and a low ceiling. Because he has strong support of the ideologues and their low turnout contests, he's got that high floor, and he's not going to go much below mid-20s in any contest. But he also can't go over 50% unless it's an extremely low turnout primary, and his normal ceiling would be upper 30s, 40 max in the most conservative states. So he's got a high floor, low ceiling, and therefore happiness for Pat Buchanan is a divided opposition. The opposite is true for Bob Dole. If Dole could only get a one-on-one with Pat Buchanan, he would beat him in most places. Maybe not every place. Some southern states might be inclined to go for Buchanan. But in most places, Dole would be able to win. Lamar Alexander would be able to win in most places one-on-one. For that matter, even Steve Forbes would be able to win against Buchanan one-on-one in most places. But it's not going to happen for a while. I still believe that a brokered convention is not a probability, but it is a distinct possibility because of the continuance of four strong candidates. We'll have to see, obviously, as it develops. Normally in an election season, one or two or three primaries or caucuses are called critical, really important contests. This year, every primary and caucus is turning out to be critical. I love it. It's great for people like me, you know, and of course I live on chaos. You know, I want chaos all the way through to San Diego and all the way to November if we can continue it somehow or another, because it only helps people in my business. But for a party, it's not a very good condition. It hurts. So in any event, Dole's got a lot at stake in South Carolina. He's really got to win. I mean, it's do or die. He had the same advantages in New Hampshire, and he blew it. And I'm going to conclude after a few more minutes of discussing this by making a remark or two about New Hampshire and Iowa and what I hope will happen in the future as a consequence of what's happened this year. But Dole had the same advantages in New Hampshire. He had the support of the superstructure and all the money in the world. Forbes could match him, but he had plenty of money, everything that a candidate normally needs to win, and he never caught fire. Now, maybe it's true that none of these candidates is catching fire. That is true. But the fact that that is true suggests that Dole has failed, because he was about as far ahead as any front runner since Ed Muskie. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to bring up that bad memory for Democrats. But, you know, Ed Muskie had the same advantages, and he never caught fire. He couldn't turn on the partisan electorate, which was a surprise, just as it is for Bob Dole. So South Carolina will be critical for Dole. If Buchanan wins, it's a big breakthrough for him in the South, because remember, South Carolina Saturday. Then on Tuesday, just 3 days later, you've got Georgia, which is the next southern state to vote. In addition, you've got the Yankee primary, a lot of the northeastern states. You've got Colorado on that day, where Forbes is putting a lot of his money. Just 2 days later, you've got New York, and that's turning into a major contest now between Dole and Forbes. Forbes today won a court decision, an appeals court decision, guaranteeing him access to all 31 of the congressional districts in New York, along with Dole. And remember, D'Amato and Pataki had stacked the deck. You remember reading about this. And, you know, if you can't expect D'Amato to be able to fix an election, what good is he? I mean, you know, well, he's failed. He wasn't able to fix it, at least not fully. Dole still has a big advantage. Because he had Pataki and D'Amato, Governor Pataki and Senator D'Amato, they've been able to list as delegates, because in New York you don't vote for the candidates, you vote for delegates, which confuses voters even more, which is the whole point of it. They have gotten most of the best known Republicans with high name identification to serve as delegates for Dole. Most of the people for Forbes and Buchanan, who is currently only on 18 congressional districts and can only get on a maximum of 23 if the judge rules in his favor between now and next Thursday, most of his delegates are not known either. So Dole still has a significant advantage in New York, but it's tightening, and we've already had indications that Forbes has begun to spend lavishly in New York. He's buying up all the available media time, and he clearly sees this as his next target of opportunity. I think he may also be looking at Colorado. Take a look at Colorado next Tuesday, because there are some indications that he's beginning to buy up all the available spots there too. So he's picking his targets of opportunity. Anyway, so Tuesday, South Carolina Saturday, Tuesday, Colorado, Georgia, the Yankee primary, Thursday, New York, and then the following Tuesday, Super Tuesday, which includes the two grand prizes, Texas and Florida. Then the following Tuesday, the entire Rust Belt, all the big states of the Midwest. And the Tuesday after that, the 26th of March, California. Just returned from California and found out some very interesting things out there. They're tremendously excited. They thought it would all be over by the 26th, and now they think they may actually be critical to the result. But as I indicated, every state is beginning to believe that it may be critical to the result, except for Virginia, which is the only state that does not even have a designated day for caucuses. The caucuses are held over 5 or 6 weeks' time, over a couple of months, and it's impossible even for the party leaders to know who's winning. precisely. And again, I think that's intentional. You know, we don't want to crash the party, so to speak. So anyway, we've got an incredible setup here that's designed to increase the muddle, to continue the muddle for a while longer. And we'll have to see who breaks out of the pack, if anyone does. As I say, I still wouldn't bet on a brokered convention, but it's a live possibility worth discussing for the first time in a long time. But I wouldn't get too excited about that possibility quite yet. Notice how we front-loaded everything. We've got a system now that has the primaries and caucuses bunched so tightly that voters don't get a chance to reflect much on the last contest before they have to vote. And the candidates don't get a chance to spend much time in any of these individual states, and they're skipping most of the states. There's not even time to visit them. Today is the only, in fact, it occurred at 2 and is going to be aired, it's being aired right now on CNN, the one debate in South Carolina. One debate, just 2 days ahead of the election. It's a crazy system. It's becoming crazier. And, of course, it's becoming crazier because of Iowa and New Hampshire. But I'm still going to delay that comment because I want to make one other comment. It's impossible to say how this is going to turn out for the Republicans. You can paint a picture of complete disaster and utter chaos very, very easily. You can paint a picture of disaster if Buchanan becomes the Republican nominee, disaster for the Republicans, that is. You can also paint the opposite picture, that somehow things will come out all right and they'll reunite as they begin to face Bill Clinton in the fall. I mean, it's just impossible to say. But if you look on the other side of it, you can see why Clinton is doing so remarkably well. When I was in California, I talked to leaders of both sides, and the numbers they had in their private tracking polls are just phenomenal. I have never seen a president who, frankly, has been as weak as Clinton has for all of his term in public opinion, in a public opinion sense. I mean, he has the lowest average popularity rating of any modern president, including Ford. I'm not going back to Truman, but I'm including Ford. He's a relatively weak president. He's never been very popular. He's never gotten out of the 50s. He's usually been in the 40s. Sometimes he's been in the 30s. But he's now so far ahead in California that even if the Republicans quickly reunite and run a very good race, and Clinton has problems in Bosnia, and Whitewater blows up and all the rest of it, they'll still have a tough time catching up. He's that far ahead of all of them. And that's not only his 54 electoral votes, it means that you take all of the money you would have had to spend on the incredibly expensive California media markets and transfer that money to battlegrounds in the Midwest that the Republicans will have to sweep since they don't have very much chance in California. So you can see what's happening on the other side. He's got no Democratic challenger. He had the tremendous good luck of having Colin Powell leave, and Powell would have beaten him easily, because Powell, at the very least, would have gotten a quarter of the African-American vote, assuming he got the Republican nomination, which wouldn't have been easy. But had he gotten it, it would have been virtually impossible for Clinton to have won, because a Democrat just can't win nationally without 90-plus percent of the African-American vote and an overwhelming percentage of the Hispanic vote as well. And Colin Powell would certainly have been able to get at least a quarter of the African-American vote. Clinton has got he's going to have his 37 million. He's going to hit the maximum ceiling, 37 million. He's going to spend it primarily on things to help him in the general election, get some of the fixed costs paid and the hard equipment paid for, the GOTV lists in order, do some early advertising in key districts and states. Tremendous challenge. While the Republicans are wasting all their money attacking one another, making it more difficult for their eventual nominee, right now he's got a relatively good economy. It's not a great economy. Obviously, Buchanan has proven, if nothing else, that some people see a lot of weakness in it. But at least judging by the numbers, it's been enough in the past to re-elect an incumbent president. Clinton is not your usual incumbent president, I'll grant you. But it has been enough in the past to reelect an incumbent president. Foreign policy is going reasonably well, though again, Bosnia could blow up at any moment. There could be some other horrible situation developing in Cuba or someplace else that we're not thinking about. Perhaps most importantly, Clinton is perceived now, and think about this, as toothless, and so is she, because they no longer control Congress. From 1992 to 94, Clinton was very powerful, at least theoretically, because his party controlled Congress. He could get things done, working in concert with his party leaders, and they did get a fair amount done. They didn't get nearly as much as he wanted to get done because of the health care disaster. But now that's not true. There's a check and balance. All Clinton can do really is veto and use the bully pulpit, both of which he's using well from a political standpoint. So he's less threatening. The best thing that happened to Bill Clinton during his term politically, as opposed to substantively or in policy terms, the best thing that happened to him politically was the Republican takeover of Congress. It gave him new life. He's got a devil figure to run against. He doesn't have to worry about being ill-defined as believing in nothing because now he's defined by the opposition. He opposes what they favor. So he's defined. He's got a devil figure. In modern politics, you always need a devil figure to run against. He's got one. He's got a relatively weak Republican field. The contract with America has failed. Almost none of it has been enacted. Maybe there'll be a budget deal. Maybe there won't be, but I don't think it's going to change the judgment about the contract with America. So a lot of things are moving in his favor. Now, my personal belief is, despite all the good polls and the good news and all these factors that I've just cited, assuming the Republicans don't nominate Buchanan, assuming they do not self-destruct on the way to San Diego, which you can't rule out right now, that's a live possibility. They could self-destruct. Parties have done it plenty of times before, Goldwater, McGovern, a lot of examples on the state level. It's almost like we have Oliver North running nationally. I mean, it's the same. They found the one guy could lose to Chuck Robb. Now they're trying to find the candidate who has the least chance to beat Bill Clinton. But despite all of that, assuming they don't self-destruct on the way to San Diego, I think it's going to be a very close election. And I say that not simply because Clinton is vulnerable on Bosnia, on Whitewater, and assorted scandals, and a potential downturn in the economy and clear public unrest about the economy, whatever the objective economic statistics show. But also because Bill Clinton has simply not won over very many people who voted against him in 1992. I can cite reams of polling data to support this, but let me ask you a question. Think about all of the people you know who voted for Ross Perot and George Bush. I grant you this is a university community. It may have to be long-distance relatives. But think about who, you must know somebody who voted for Bush or Perot. How many of them have been converted? How many of them have been won over by Bill Clinton during his presidency? I don't know very many. I don't know very many. And remember, that's a 57% majority. Against Pat Buchanan, it won't matter. And maybe it won't matter if the Republicans continue splitting and self-destructing. It won't matter. But if, say, they end up dominating Dole, despite all of Dole's manifest weaknesses, there's a reason why he lost twice before. You know, this is the third try. There's a reason why he hasn't caught fire. There's a reason why he was a bust as the vice presidential candidate in 1976. It's amazing how we forget these things. And then a new campaign revives your memories of why it was people rejected him. But despite all of that, I think the conditions are there for a very close election, a very close election, and not just because of that Electoral College bulge for the Republicans. So it looks great for Clinton right now, but you know how the conventional wisdom can change overnight. You know, a year ago, Clinton couldn't possibly be reelected. And remember, Dole was 12 points ahead of Clinton on average in the national public opinion polls. You see how quickly things have turned around? Well, they can turn around again. We just don't know, or they may not, but we don't know. And, you know, you listen to the Sunday morning shows and the McLaughlin Group. Incidentally, a study was just done of the McLaughlin Group. It was published in that new Harvard publication on the media that Marvin Kalb runs. And this is the third study of the McLaughlin Group and their predictions. And, you know, they're such great insiders and they know everything. And they get to pick their predictions. I mean, it's not like they're being forced to predict something for the most part that they may not know much about. They get to suggest a prediction. Well, this study and two others have shown that you would be better off flipping a coin than listening to their predictions, because on average, their predictions, self-selected predictions, are 44% correct, and assuming you have two options, it would be on average 50% correct with a coin. So, you know, the pundits are very, very certain of everything at the moment they say it, and they realize television's ephemeral and it doesn't matter. It's here today and gone tomorrow, and nobody remembers, and nobody, thank God, holds pundits accountable for what they say. Nobody remembers. But keep that in mind, that that the conditions are still there for a relatively close election. And I'm going to close by suggesting that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, there may be a positive development on account of the mess on the Republican side, the muddle on the Republican side in this presidential selection contest. And that is that Louisiana, for all of its many faults, and the horrible way they set up their primary, and Delaware, which was virtually ignored but ended up being very significant by giving Forbes new life, which he translated into a major win in Arizona on Tuesday. Louisiana and Delaware have done what their sister states had been afraid to do for the past 40 years, which is to challenge, in New Hampshire's case at least, to challenge the first in the nation status of two terribly unrepresentative states. New Hampshire is 99% white. Iowa is 98% white. Neither one of them has large urban centers with the attendant urban problems. Both of them are heavily agricultural. Each of them have idiosyncrasies which skew the results of their primaries or caucuses. Iowa on the Democratic side is heavy, very heavy on the peace activists. On the Republican side, it's one of the strongest states for the Christian coalition. New Hampshire is filled with gun nuts and tax advocates who view a penny tax increase on the gasoline taxes as cause for rebellion or lining you up against a barn door and shooting you through the eyes. They are terribly, horribly unrepresentative. They are arrogant. The two of them together have only 1.5% of the U.S. population. It is crazy that every 4 years we let those two terribly unrepresentative states have such a disproportionate impact on the presidential nominating process. And I think that the result of Buchanan winning in New Hampshire, combined with the success that Louisiana and Delaware had in attracting media attention and media dollars and candidates who promised to appoint local Pauls to high office if they won the primary in their states, the combination of all those factors will mean that some other more representative states will challenge Iowa and New Hampshire in the year 2000, and we will all be better for that, particularly if they prevail. And I will, on that point of advocacy, Ken, I will stop.
Who'd like to ask the first question?
Yes. What's the Brokerage Convention, and how did they get started?
I missed your first.
You're talking about a brokerage convention.
Oh, a broker convention?
How does it get started, and what is it?
Well, a broker convention means that no candidate has a majority of the delegates going in, and therefore there must be some horse trading at the convention. And of course, American history is full of examples of broker conventions of one sort or another. In fact, the count I saw was 8 for this century. So they're hardly unknown even in this century, but we haven't had one in a long time, and there's a reason for that. Today, the party bosses are virtually non-existent, except in a few places. You know, Little Mayor Daley is still very important in Chicago, and Al D'Amato is still very important in New York, although we'll find out how important next Thursday. Secondly, the delegates elected today are almost all elected pledged. There are only a handful of unpledged or uncommitted delegates. And the Democratic Party has some elected officials as well that are unpledged, but many of them get pledged too. So you've got very few unpledged delegates. Well, who are these delegates? They're picked by the candidates themselves. They run on those slates picked by the candidates. They're the ultra-loyalists. They are the least likely to switch to anybody else given new circumstances unless the candidate they're pledged to tells them to switch. So a brokered convention today will be completely different from brokered conventions in the past in the sense that it will not be party bosses sitting at a table brokering the convention, divvying up the delegates. It will be the candidates who will sit there and decide what happens, and undoubtedly they will demand this and demand that, demand a position in the cabinet or the vice presidential nomination or whatever may be the case if it goes that far. But you know, the brokering can take place long before you get to San Diego. I mean, that could happen too. And I still think the probability is there won't be brokering at all, but we'll see what happens. It's really unpredictable, and I wouldn't be foolhardy enough to make such a prediction.
Thanks. Yes, Ray.
Larry, why do you think?
Oh, Ray, how are you?
Why do you think Clinton hasn't been able to win over the parole people and the other people?
Or you know, it's such a contradiction. I have to tell you honestly where I stand in that. I thoroughly disagree with both the Clinton haters and the Clinton lovers because I think both groups ignore sides of this very complicated individual. And there are sides of him that I find entrancing. I mean, he is quite literally one of the two or three best politicians I have ever known or seen. I've just never come across anybody who can do what he does, can work the miracles he works on the stump, in communicating one-on-one. I see some of you grimacing, and you don't like to hear that, so you're in the Clinton-hater camp. But he's really good at it, and that matters. It really matters, and it helps to put together coalitions, and it helps to smooth the way toward a president getting done what he has to get done. And then the other side of Clinton, I find somewhat repulsive, to be perfectly honest. And, you know, I don't think deep down he does believe in a whole lot. I would say maybe civil rights, but I have a hard time, if pressed, thinking of what second or third. You know, there's not a whole lot there. The personal life stuff, much of it I think, frankly, should not be in the public sphere, but some of it is legitimate because some of it represents pure recklessness on the part of someone who is in high public office and has been in high public office for a long time. And I can tell you, as somebody who has very thoroughly and personally investigated a lot of it, there's a heck of a lot of it there. And it bothers me and it worries me and I don't like it and I don't like to see it in somebody in as high an office as he's in. For that matter, I'd like to see it in a governor, which he was in a governorship from 1978 on, except for that 2-year period between 80 and 82 in Arkansas. Why hasn't he been able to win people over? Because even though I think just about everybody recognizes that he's highly intelligent, very able, a terrific politician, that he has many, many talents that would help him to govern well, they don't trust him at a very basic level. And even more importantly, and this is telling, they don't respect him as president. Maybe it was the draft, or maybe it was the extramarital affairs, or maybe it's the lack of a political core. But for a combination of reasons, people seem neither to trust nor to respect him. And that's very unusual in a president. You know, for years and years, whether you supported or opposed a president, you would cede certain things to the presidency, with maybe the exception of Richard Nixon. You know, Nixon seemed to evoke the same kinds of emotions in Democrats and many independents that Clinton does in Republicans and many independents. No matter what they did, people didn't like or trust them or respect them.
What ideas do you think that have been introduced so far that could really catch fire and really, other than the old long time, what new ideas? Do you see any new ideas that can really strike the fire and gets the campaign going?
Well, I like to fool myself and think that I'm relatively young. But already, even after doing this for only 25 years, I know that there aren't any new ideas. They're just repackaged old and medium-term young ideas. And that's pretty much it. Walter Mondale had the best line ever. You remember 1984 when after weeks of Gary Hart touting his new ideas, so Walter Mondale turned to him and said, "Where's the beef?" You know, from the hamburger commercial. And there, it turned out there wasn't much there. There was not a whole lot. Well, there was some beef cake, but there wasn't much beef. In any event, flat tax has probably been the one most discussed, and it's a marvelously attractive idea until you look at the details. It's on the surface, it promises wonderful things for everybody and a brighter future and lower taxes and then you wonder how the bills are going to get paid. You come back to that old snake oil that, oh, well, if you lower the taxes, then the economy will really rev and revenues will be generated like you couldn't believe. And that will solve the deficit problem. And, of course, that's how we got $1.5 trillion of the current $5 trillion debt in this country. But I don't see a whole lot that's terribly new on either side. You'll see a lot of repackaged ideas. You'll see more on the social front in both parties because for the first time since the mid-1960s, a majority of voters who voted in a congressional election in 1994 said they were more concerned about social issues than the economy. They didn't think the economy was going well, but they were more concerned about the fact that they viewed society as sinking into moral degradation. They were concerned about the decline of the family structure and so on and so forth. So that was highly unusual, and on account of that, because all politicians fight the last war, they will respond to the sentiments expressed in 94 by taking lots of stance on social issues in 96.
Next. Yes, Peggy.
Do you really think, Larry, that any of these Republican candidates can
be Clinton? Sure, under some conditions, absolutely. There are lots of things that can happen between now and November. Lots of things. If the election were held today, no. But the election is not today, it's in November. And this is February. And, you know, I can remember giving talks about elections in October with the certitude of conventional wisdom and 467 polls and the views of every political analyst and political leader imaginable. And then by election day, things had been turned on their head by some development or another. So I sure know that in February, there is no one who can predict the result. My favorite motto, which I use all the time for political analysts, is that he who lives by the crystal ball ends up eating ground glass. So the heck with predicting the future. I'll leave that to the McLaughlin group.
Yes.
Can you give us your views on what's happening to the electorate, Larry, in terms of its policy? Is this country beginning to flirt with new isolationism, or is this just a normal kind of thing after a great effort that we had in the Cold War is over?
Well, Don, as you know much better than I do, because that's your field, I think that isolationism has always had an attraction for American voters, and the periods of true internationalism were exceptions rather than rather than the norm. I see Norman Graber here. I am talking about to something like this, and I ought to defer to both Don and to Norman to discuss this more thoroughly. But I think that generally speaking, would you agree with me, Norman, that that periods of internationalism were exceptional rather than normality in American history? And so isolationism, that the new isolationism we're seeing today is very real, and you know it's in both parties. It's in both parties. The odd thing is that Democrats, which since Vietnam have tended to be more isolationist than the Republicans, the Democrats, because of Clinton's term, may now be more internationalist, probably are more internationalist than the Republicans, where isolationism has seemed to take deeper root. Probably the advantage for internationalism is that the vast majority of party and political leaders in both parties are still internationalists. However, Perot isn't. Independents aren't. They're more strongly isolationist than Republicans, who are more strongly isolationist than Democrats.
So would you just say a word, though, about Buchanan's impact on this? Is he representative of something much deeper, or is this a passing thing?
I don't think that it's terribly deep if you're looking at majority sentiments. He's representing a relatively small group in one party. They're voting at a very high level because he's an ideologue. He turns the key to their motors. They're more likely to turn out than are others who are less turned on by any of the candidates. But you're talking about a relatively small slice of people. Now, there's a slice in the Democratic Party, too, blue-collar workers who either have lost their jobs or are threatened by job losses because of increased international trade or other factors. But I don't think it's anywhere near majority sentiment, and those aspects that are not felt intensely by people.
Jill and John Wright.
Since your book, Feeding Frenzy, do you think the media are taking a more responsible role, projecting more about issues, less cynicism? Do you think the people are learning any more in the 96 election than they had in past elections?
Goodness, no. I wish I could give you good news, but I'm sorry I've been at this too long. I should point out that most journalists don't share my view of journalism, obviously. In fact, I don't know how many of you saw the Sunday Times last Sunday. Hal Raines, who's kind of a friend, and who was one of my interviewees for Feeding Frenzy, started out a signed editorial on James Fallow's new book, criticizing the news media for many of the same reasons I criticized them for in 1991. He started out to his editorial by saying James Fallows has written the book that includes the worst ideas for good solid journalism since Larry Sabato's Feeding Frenzy. And I think that's typical of the view in journalism. But I don't mind, a plug is a plug is a plug, right? My publisher was thrilled. He suggested I send a nasty letter to Rain, see if I could stimulate another editorial. But anyway, no, I don't think things are getting better at all. In fact, if you look at the data being compiled by places like the Center for Media and Public Affairs, you'll find that coverage of the horse race is greater today than it was in 92 or 88 or 84. That a smaller slice of the coverage on television and in the major newspapers, and particularly on television, is devoted to substantive policy rather than who's ahead, who's behind, and who's gaining. So no, I don't think things are getting better. I think they're getting worse.
John Wright.
Larry, what about Perot and his organization? They seem to have disappeared into the woodwork.
They'll be back.
Do you really think they'll come back after the nominee is selected?
They're already planning for it. You remember, in my business, we call Ross Perot the political equivalent of a drive-by shooting. He's loading the gun, and of course the driver has the car waiting. It's just a matter of time until we see him again, and we will. Remember, they've set their convention for Labor Day, and they're working. You don't think Perot is spending more of his millions to get the Reform/Independent Party on the ballot in all 50 states just for fun? He's planning. You know, it's like having the shiniest new fire engine on the block and not taking it to the fire. He'll take it to the fire. It's just a question of who is the nominee, and everybody assumes it'll be Perot. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. We'll have to see who it turns out to be. And part of it depends on how fractured the Republicans are, because Bill Bennett's already promised, and he'll fulfill the promise, that if Buchanan ends up being the Republican nominee, there'll be a Republican third party. They'll have their own candidate who may or may not be endorsed by Perot's Reform Party. They're planning a real extravaganza for Labor Day. They're even talking about having some kind of system via internet whereby people can vote by computer for the party nominee, assuming there's a contest. So who knows what will develop, but it will be interactive.
How has this stayed out of the media so much?
Because the focus is on the Republican contest right now. I mean, even Clinton has to fight to get into the news. You know, and he's the president. I mean, the media can, as numerous as they are, they're a lumbering giant. They can really only focus on one major event at a time, at least the political part of journalism, and they're focusing on the Republican contest, and they say there'll be time enough for that. There'll be time enough for that, and they're right. They're right.
Next. Yes, Bill Stevenson.
Do you have any comment on the congressional races, with particular reference to whether the Republicans would ever be able to get enough of a coalition to override the Clinton vetoes?
In the House, no. It's always possible in the Senate. But look, the reason why Newt Gingrich is so nervous is because he knows that the better Buchanan does, the less chance he has of remaining speaker. He knows if Buchanan's a nominee, it's gone. I mean, it's really a question of whether the Republicans lose the Senate, too. They will certainly lose the House if Buchanan is the nominee. My guess is, the surprise, the shock of election night will be they'll lose the Senate too, which nobody currently thinks is possible. Even if Buchanan only does very well and goes into the Republican convention with a large block of delegates and gives another one of those stellar primetime performances of his like 1992, he's gonna hurt the Republican Party. He's going to hurt their image at precisely the time when the nominee will have to try and put the pieces back together and moderate the image to appeal to independents and centrists for the fall. So, it could still turn out favorably for the Republicans. For example, let's just suppose Buchanan was nominated. You'd have Clinton, you'd have Buchanan, you'd have that other Republican candidate running as an independent. You may or may not have a Perot candidate as well. Well, look at that race. Clinton would almost certainly get well less than 50% of the vote, even while probably winning. Well, the other three parties or independent candidates are Republican-oriented. Almost all of their votes would end up going to Republican candidates for the Senate and the House. So that's how the Republicans could lose the presidency in a landslide and still hold on to both houses of Congress. It could happen. If it's a two-way race and Clinton wins, even if it's 52-48, you have the possibility of Democrats regaining the House. Remember, they're only 21-22 votes behind, 21-22 seats in the House of Representatives. That's not a big swing. And there's going to be some and it's possible, but I think very unlikely.
Next question. Yes.
What do you suggest that you tell to young people to encourage them to take part in the electoral process and not be disillusioned by politicians who make promises?
Oh, well, I've got the solution to that. I'll show it to you.
I've been passing these out to every one of my students for years. Politics is a good thing. Notice it does not say politicians are good things. I mean, I'm not going to try the impossible, trying to convince people that politicians are good things. But the process itself is, you know, to apply Winston Churchill's dictum about democracy, our politics is the worst possible system except for all the others. And it's the way, still the best way to get things done, the way to improve your communities and states and your nation. And to me, this is the message we ought to be sending in civics classes. And you've read the new reports on civic education, which show how it's deteriorated and how little there is of it anymore in the primary and secondary schools, despite what my friends in primary and secondary education tell me. There's relatively little of it left. We've got to restore civic education to the primary and secondary schools to the degree that we once had it. And I think there are innovations like mock elections that ought to be done everywhere, every year. I've long believed that we ought to bring the voting machines in September or October and have a day in the schools devoted to having representatives of all the candidates running in that particular year for that set of offices in for everyone from kindergarten through senior year in high school, and have them listen to the presentations and have some of the hoopla and the bunting, and then go into the voting booths and actually cast a ballot. You know, a percentage of our non-voter turnout is voter booth phobia. It's called, there's a formal name for it that I won't bore you with, but it's voter booth phobia. A lot of people are afraid to go into the voting booth. They're afraid they can't operate it and will keep people waiting. And, you know, if we got students used to using the voting booths every single year, and they therefore would have used it for 12 or 13 years, maybe even continuing it in some colleges, like Washington and Lee is doing with their mock convention this weekend, then I think we'd have a higher voter participation rate. So there are a lot of things that we can do that we're not doing, and I think we ought to be doing them, especially in primary and secondary schools.
Next question.
That's interesting.
Frank Elliott.
What's your view on mailing ballot election? And you indicated internet utilization in that regard. Do you think it's a move in the right direction, or do you think it's detrimental to our political process?
There are good points to be made on both sides, but on balance, I'm opposed. I know that the recent Oregon election was reasonably successful. There was a higher turnout, and that's a good thing. There was generally a well-run election there. There was very little voter fraud. But I would point out several things. First of all, we lose the community aspect of elections. And I know it's diminished anyway, but I still think it's very important for people to go to that central place and to see their fellow citizens and to see people handing out handbills, to participate in the process personally in that vital civic ritual, maybe the most important one that we all participate in annually. It's something I don't want to see decline any further than it already has. Secondly, despite the experience in Oregon, which remember has a progressive tradition and is a very clean state, always has been politically, that is not true of many of the other states. I've got a new book coming out. Let me put it on a plug for Dirty Little Secrets coming out in April from Times Books and Random House. Available at all local bookstores, and makes a wonderful holiday gift. Did I do that right, Ennis? Okay. One of the major chapters is devoted to something I spent 3 years on, which is looking at something the press doesn't believe exists anymore. You know, when we're not looking for corruption, there's likely to be more of it. You can get away with a lot more when people think it doesn't exist. You're going to be shocked to find out just how much voter fraud still exists in this country. And I'm not just talking about Chicago. I focused on Philadelphia, Alabama, Texas, and California. And I was personally stunned. And I did on-site investigations. My co-author is a Wall Street Journal investigative reporter by the name of Glenn Simpson. It's shocking. It's stunning. And most of the fraud is with absentee ballots, with people going door to door and collecting the ballots right after the postmaster delivers them, are going in and helpfully filling out the ballots for invalids at nursing homes and health care centers. You wouldn't believe what's going on. And there are far more of those states with traditions that tolerate and even encourage voter fraud than there are states like Oregon. And so mail-in voting will inevitably encourage voter fraud in many places. So that's in addition to losing the great tradition of civic participation on Election Day. And so I'm opposed. I'm opposed.
Yes, yes.
How is the New Hampshire primary structured? If you're a registered Democrat, can you cross the line and vote in the Republican primary?
No, you're allowed to re-register, though, up until a very short period prior to the actual primary. And then you can re-register. If you're a Democrat, you register as a Republican or an independent. Independents are allowed to vote. And the rules vary by state. Every state has a different set of rules. You know, in Virginia, we don't even have party registration. 25 states have party registration, 25 states don't. We're in the 25 that does not. And that means that in Virginia, anybody can vote in any primary. And John Warner, I'm sure, will be very grateful for that, because the only shot he's got at being renominated is getting lots of Democrats and independents to that June 11th primary. Let me tell you, that's his only shot. And Democrats view it as owing him three. They owe him three. They owe him for Bork. They owe him for Ferris, and they owe him for North. And he's going to call in those chits. If only Republicans show up June 11th, he'll lose. His renomination depends on independents and Democrats, in addition to moderate Republicans who will vote for him.
Yes.
What impact is the registering through motor vehicles and registering the vote, in your judgment, going to have presidential?
It will marginally increase voter turnout in all likelihood. It is not going to have a tremendous impact on the results. In fact, so far, Republicans have actually done a little bit better under motor voter than Democrats have. They've actually registered more of their people than Democrats have. Not everywhere, not in every congressional district, not in every state, but overall, that is in fact the current practice. In the long run, I would personally, as Democrats get better organized and take advantage of the provisions of the motor voter, so-called motor voter law, I would expect Democrats to do marginally better in most states. But that's just a guess on my part. But overall, I don't expect it to have an enormous impact, and certainly not in 1996. It's too early.
Yet Governor Allen is opposed to it?
Yeah, well, he's already given in. It's over. The court tests were run in several different states, particularly California, and governors who challenged it, and they were all Republicans, they lost every single court challenge. And so Allen has given in, and it's going into effect either July 1st, or if they can get the emergency provision attached almost immediately.
Knight Aldrich.
Larry, do you think Al Gore figures he can be nominated and elected in the year 2000? And if so, what should he do to further his chances?
Well, of course he thinks that. He will be challenged by Dick Gephardt and probably Bill Bradley. He'll have a run for it. He'll have a fight for it. If he's the incumbent vice president and Clinton doesn't have a disastrous second term, he will be a heavy favorite. If Clinton has a very unhappy second term, if he has a second term at all, then the challenge to Gore will be severe because, of course, Gore, for better or worse, will have to carry that burden. Whether he's responsible for Clinton's mistakes or not, as the vice president, he will have to carry that burden in the nominating process in the year 2000. So it will depend on whether Clinton's reelected or not. If he's not reelected, I suppose the good news for Gore is in 4 years, people will forget most of the foibles of the Clinton administration, and it won't hurt him one way or the other. The bad news is he won't have the machinery of the party and government at his disposal as he would have as an incumbent vice president. I love predicting, at least 4 years in advance, because nobody will ever remember. You can say the most outrageous things.
Victor Yonke.
Is it possible, if it comes down to a brokered convention for the Republicans, sort of standoff, that they'll go back and find a very good Republican governor for the role?
Anything's possible. Look, I think my view on this election year so far is that every single good citizen is entitled to his or her own scenario. because as far as I'm concerned, one is as good as the next right now. There are so many possibilities. And so sure, that's possible. That's possible. Given the likely composition of the Republican convention, if things continue going pretty much as they are, that governor would have to be conservative. I think it would be very difficult for, say, a Christy Whitman to end up getting nominated. It would be very difficult for Colin Powell to end up getting nominated. But sure, it's possible. But, you know, again, you have to remember, these delegates being elected have sweated bullets for their candidate. And it seems to me that the candidates sitting at that table, if there's a brokered convention, are going to be very unlikely to deal anybody else in. Somebody who hasn't slogged through the snows of New Hampshire. Somebody who hasn't visited all of the stinking pig farms in Iowa. You know, they endured a lot to get there. Are they really going to hand the grand prize to somebody who didn't have to stay in any Holiday Inns and got fed at regular times during the whole process? I don't think so. I think they're going to deal among themselves. But that's just my guess, and it could be totally wrong.
As we came in on the dot, the second, in fact, as all German professors do, Larry said he had an important meeting on the lawn at 20 paces with Pat Buchanan. In order to make that appointment, it's going to be necessary for him to get out of here before some of you get out. And so I've worked until midnight on a very substantive introduction to him, and not with your pleasure. I'm going to make a few of these points so that he can get out of the door. And
I appreciate
for that, we want to thank him very much.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me. Do you want me to leave? Oh, my God. It's like a reverse Miss America contest. You get to leave as you're being introduced. Thanks a lot.
Most of you don't know that Larry's the undergraduate advisor, and others don't know that he spends an enormous time with his students, despite his far-flung research activities. So I thought you might enjoy knowing that. Second thing you might enjoy knowing is that Larry is not necessarily a wordsmith, but he is a titlesmith, and I thought you might want to rehearse his titles. When Should the Watchdogs Bark? Feeding Frenzy, How to Attack Reforms of Paying for Elections. The Party Just Begun. Pack Power. Good Time Charlie, The American Governorship Transformed. The Rise of Political Consultants, and so on and so forth. The other thing, since he's left and won't get any more of a large head than he already has, Larry is nationally and internationally recognized. He was a fellow at Downing College at Cambridge. He's been on at least 8 or 10 national commissions. He participated in, as you know, in press and media activities around the country, and we're very fortunate to have him at Virginia. Thank you very much. He's gone, and if you hear a shot, you'll know what's happened.
A little more interesting than a lot of the other people.